This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
President Ibrahim Raisi tells Pakistan's top general that one of Iran's top priorities is to turn shared borders into safe trade corridors. Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani is in Syria, the first such trip by an Iraqi premier since 2010. Also ahead, the Russian president warns that Moscow will retaliate in kind if Ukraine uses the cluster munitions it has received from the United States. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, Iran's president says the country seriously pursues efforts to boost economic ties with neighboring Pakistan. Ibrahim Raisi says Iran follows a strategy to turn shared borders into a secure environment conducive to economic collaboration. Raisi was speaking in a meeting with Pakistan's Chief of Army Staff, Major General Asim Munir, in Tehran. The Iranian president said Tehran and Islamabad must work to develop border markets and boost energy cooperation through implementing previous agreements. Raisi said Iran has prioritized developing relations with neighboring Muslim and friendly nations. He warned that enemies are trying to disrupt relations between regional nations. The Pakistani general, for his part, hailed Iran's policy of prioritizing ties with neighbors, saying this is a great opportunity for the Muslim world. General Munir said Pakistan is now focusing on expediting efforts to ensure long-term security in the border areas. He said increased economic cooperation would help boost the border region. An official Iraqi delegation headed by the country's prime minister has arrived in the Syrian capital, Damascus, to meet with top Syrian officials and President Bashar al-Assad. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali has the details from Damascus.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed al-Sudani has arrived in Damascus, where he was received in an official welcoming ceremony by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The two leaders held talks discussing bilateral relations and means of enhancing them, especially in trade exchange, transport and industry, as well as in the political field and joint efforts in fighting terror and securing their shared 600-kilometer border from security threats. Assad said this visit is an opportunity to establish institutional relations and boost bilateral cooperation. The Iraqi top official said the Iraqi people are proud of Syrians' steadfastness. The two sides held a press conference underlining the importance of collaboration to address joint challenges such as terror, drug smuggling, and water shortages.
There are challenges we face directly, mainly terrorism and cooperation in countering it. Terrorism is active due to Western support, using it as a tool to target countries adhering to its independence and national interests. Some regional countries also supported terrorism. The biggest challenge is the Syrian and Iraqi people being deprived of their share of the Euphrates water, which results in thirst, hunger, and illnesses. We also have challenges on drugs, which can destroy societies.
Assad noted that economic ties will be the focus of future discussions with the aim of overcoming the economic siege on Syria. He praised Iraq for its years-long support for Syria during the war. Al-Sudani reiterated his country's support for Syria's unity, referring to the necessity of solving the refugee situation.
Iraq's support for Syria's sovereignty and the government's control of all its territories is a matter of interest to Iraqi national security. The Syrian and Iraqi blood shed together portrays the clearest images of relations between both countries. The biggest joint challenges today are security and economy. We need more coordination. Today, we are creating mechanisms for such coordination.
Al-Sudani said Syria cannot be left alone in facing difficulties and called for lifting the unjust Western sanctions on the Arab country. He denounced the Israeli occupation of Arab lands, as well as the regime's aggressions on Syria and Lebanon. The Iraqi official is accompanied by ministers of foreign affairs and trade, as well as the deputy chief of joint operations in Iraq. The Iraqi prime minister's visit comes at a crucial time in which both countries are in a desperate need for increasing economic cooperation to overcome difficulties resulting from wars. Both states have for long suffered from Daesh terrorism, and high-level talks can strengthen joint efforts for countering terror. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Well, earlier in our news review program, we took a closer look at Syria-Iraq relations. Let's see what our guests had to say.
Okay, for some insight on this, let me invite Asaf Shath. He's an author and Middle East expert joining me from Belfast. Also with me is Faraz Ali, a political commentator from Malmo, Sweden. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Saab, let's talk about how important this visit is. It's after 12, 13 years. What is it? Of course, Iraq and Syria have had cooperation, but now it seems that they are more determined to further forge cooperation. Tell us about the significance of this proximity.
This is a very important visit, which is the Prime Minister of Iraq is conducting in Syria. This is comes in an international situation which differs than before, and we see the pilgrim of Arab states coming back to build the relationship with Syria, and on the back of the success of the Syrian regime in fighting terror. We know the both states have nearly 600 kilometers of border, joint border, which they share. And they organized their own, together, their own campaign against Takfiri groups in Iraq. We know a third of Iraq was under Daesh, and from Iraq went into Syria. And the Syrian and Iraqi joint forces defeated that terror, of course, with help with others like Iran. But this visit comes in a very important juncture. Since these countries, returning their Arabic countries, rebuilding their relationship with Syria. The other thing is, United States of America, when it was defeated militarily in Iraq, it's maintained according with the SOFA agreement, which is drawn up in Iraq with the Iraqi politicians, which some of them were implanted by the United States of America then, maintained economical like a stagnation hold over Iraq economy till today. So the Iraqis, when this Iraq visit in Syria and they're discussing a pipeline going from Iraq to the Mediterranean to export or beside the exportation of Iraqi oil through Syria as well. This means Iraq is trying to break from the stranglehold, economical stranglehold of the United States of America. And this will work positive for the both sides.
Now, Faraz, how do you look at this? I mean, what are those fields that the two countries need to prioritize and to start with when it comes to enhancing and cementing their relations?
Well, firstly, I agree with your guest here, because I don't want to repeat what he says, but we can put what he said in a context. Iraq and Syria has a common past and presence, because like Syria, Iraq has been through terrorism, foreign bacteria on its soil. Iraq has experienced devastating, brutal U.S. sanctions, as Syria does now. And Iraq has also experienced the occupation of its land from U.S. forces, as Syria does now with both Turkish and U.S. forces, the NATO occupation of Syria. Mm-hmm. So in that case, both countries understand each other and understand their challenges, and they, as your guest said, share a long border, so they share a future together. There is a problem, except for what your guest mentioned, there is also a problem with cross-border drug trafficking, cross-border Iraq and Syria. And that's something that both the Syrian president and the Iraqi prime minister said that they will counter, because as always, the Western countries, and especially United States of America, they also always accuse others of what they are doing themselves. Like for now, they have sanctioned Syrian officials, accusing them of producing and transporting drugs to Iraq. Well, everyone knows that the fact that when United States left Afghanistan, the poppy production went to zero. But the West are like that. No one would question US officials. No one would sanction them. So Iraq and Syria, when Syria is back in the Arab League and the Arab world has opened up to Iraq now, Iraq was the only Arab country who didn't cut ties with Syria, despite everything that happened there.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Let me thank our guests, Saab Shahs in Belfast, Northern Ireland, for us, Ali in Malmo, Sweden. That's it for this episode of the News Review.
Turning elsewhere now, the Russian Defense Ministry says it has repelled the Ukraine's attack on the Crimean port city of Sevastopol. The ministry said in a statement that it has destroyed seven aerial and two underwater drones that were trying to attack targets in and around the city. It said no casualties or damage were caused. Sevastopol rejoined Russia in 2014 after a referendum. The city is home to Russia's Black Sea Fleet. It has been the scene of drone attacks by Ukraine since the breakout of the war in February last year. A shooting operation near an Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank has left three Israelis wounded. Earlier, our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us with the latest on the incident.
The Israeli military imposed curfew and closure on the Bethlehem city. Later, the Israeli forces raided the city of Bethlehem and claimed they found the vehicle that Palestinians were inside and used to shoot at Israeli settlers. Clashes erupted between Israeli forces and Palestinians. According to Palestinian paramedics, five Palestinians were wounded during this military operation in Bethlehem. Later, Israeli troops arrested a number of Palestinians, saying that at least one of those Palestinians was the shooter who carried out the shooting at the Taqwa junction. The Israeli forces surrounded a mosque, claiming Palestinians were inside. However, Palestinian worshippers were inside it, and following the Al-Asr prayers while worshippers were leaving the mosque, three Palestinians were arrested from inside a Rabat mosque in Bethlehem. The Israelis said that one Palestinian was the shooter, and two others, they believe that they might help the shooter. Hamas, following the operation, immediately issued a statement saying that it's a natural response and praised this operation a natural response while the Israeli crimes continue to take place across the occupied West Bank.
Let's just return to our earlier story regarding the Ukrainian attack on the Crimean port city of Sevastopol that Moscow says has been repelled. Our correspondent in Moscow, Johnny Miller, says Sunday's attack was one of the largest ones since the beginning of the war.
This is one of the largest attacks since the war began last year. As you say, aerial drones, water drones, some footage coming out of Russia destroying these drones, sometimes even with small arms fire. So we think there's been no damage to the Russian Black Sea Fleet. Ukraine have had very little success with these attacks. Crimea, particularly Sevastopol, is one of the places in the world with the strongest air defense because of Russia's fleet there. So another attempt by Ukraine to damage the fleet, and may well be connected to the ending of the grain deal as well. We see increasing escalation on the battlefield, and still little talk of peace, particularly as this Ukrainian counteroffensive looks like it's failing. There is hope that we'll see more signs of peace now, but not happening at the moment.
Meanwhile, Russia warns Ukraine against the use of cluster munitions against Moscow, saying it's ready to retaliate with the same type of weapons.
I'd like to note that the Russian Federation has a sufficient stockpile of different types of cluster munitions. Different types. We haven't done this before, we didn't use them, and we didn't have to despite of a known lack of munitions at a certain period of time. We didn't do it. But, of course, if they are used against us, we reserve the right to take reciprocal action.
Putin said Ukraine's counteroffensive against Russia has not been successful. He also said Russian specialists should examine captured Western military equipment to see if anything useful could be used in Russia's own army. Ukraine has recently started receiving cluster weapons from its main supporter, the United States. Washington's decision was opposed by many countries, including U.S. allies. Germans have held a rally to protest against their country and NATO's military support for Ukraine. The protest was held in the city of Düsseldorf. The protesters said the world peace cannot be achieved with NATO. The demonstration was held after the German government approved a €600 million military package for Kiev. Berlin's package is said to include two launch units for the Patriot air missile system and 25 Leopard 1 tanks. Germany is Ukraine's second biggest military sponsor in Europe after the UK. The German protesters also slammed the European deception on the war in Ukraine.
This shows the horrible double standard of German and European politics. On one side speaking about peace, and on the other side in reality doing the opposite.
The protesters also criticized the U.S. for its recent shipment of widely banned cluster munitions to Ukraine. Many countries have condemned the U.S. move, including U.S. allies. The munitions are considered as a major threat to civilians as they release large numbers of bomblets that can kill indiscriminately over a wide area. More than 120 countries have signed a convention banning the use of cluster bombs. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Scientists say even moderate heat strains the human heart. They say people can experience cardiovascular strain, a progressive increase in heart rate, before their internal temperatures are affected. In this regard, the scientific magazine Nature has provided an exclusive article. Stay tuned for more.
Yeah.
A recent study has found air temperatures as low as 34 degrees Celsius can lead to a steady increase in heart rate under humid conditions. This rise, also known as cardiovascular strain, occurs even before a person's internal temperature starts to rise. The findings are among a slew of recent results about the heart's struggles when exposed to heat. Scientists say this work is becoming even more relevant as extreme heat events become more frequent. Just recently, the average temperature worldwide hit a record high 2 days in a row. Rachel Cottle, a researcher in exercise physiology at the Pennsylvania State University in State College and co-author of the paper, which was published recently in the Journal of Applied Physiology, said, "More people are going to be exposed to heat waves and potentially be at risk. But work to identify the combination of temperature and humidity that endangers the heart could inform strategies to protect human health," she says. To pinpoint the threshold for heart risk, Cottle and her colleagues had young, healthy participants engage in light physical activity inside an environmental chamber, whose temperature or humidity rose every 5 minutes. The researchers monitored each individual's core temperature, the temperature of their internal organs, using sensors inside capsules that the participants had swallowed. The team also measured participants' heart rates. As the chamber got hotter, participants' heart rates increased and then plateaued. But as the chamber continued to heat up, the volunteers' heart rates started to rise again and were still rising when the experiment ended. Indicating cardiovascular strain in humid conditions, participants who were walking slowly experienced cardiovascular strain when the temperature was around 34 degrees Celsius. When the air was dry, that threshold was around 41 degrees Celsius. Cardiovascular strain always began about 20 minutes before the participants' core temperatures started to rise. Because heart rate is so easy to measure, it could be a useful warning sign. Cottle says, if all of a sudden you notice your heart rate going up quickly and progressively, then that might mean that your core temperature will start to rise. That's when you need to take precautionary measures. But Craig Crandall, director of the Thermal and Vascular Physiology Lab at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas, is cautious. The team's finding that heart rate goes up before core temperature might stem from delays between a rise in core temperature and its measurement in the gut, he says. Other research has shown that heat can affect the heart even when people are not moving. A study by Louis Hasley at the University of Rompton in London and his colleagues found that at 50% humidity, the heart rate of participants at rest was, on average, 64% higher at 50 degrees Celsius than 28 degrees Celsius. Halsey says, so if you are resting and you're out in the sun, on the beach or whatever, your heart rate will still increase. When the temperature rises, the human body typically activates two main mechanisms to regulate core temperatures: sweating and increasing the blood flow from the core to the skin. While this is happening, you also have an increased metabolic demand that requires an increased heart rate, says Barack Almond, a specialist in climate change and health at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Massachusetts, adding, "So we are asking the heart to work harder while taking blood away from it. For healthy young adults, that extra effort might be harmless, but for older people or those with existing heart conditions, exposure to extreme heat could be lethal. According to a 2022 meta-analysis, a temperature increase of just 1 degree Celsius is associated with a 2.1% increase in the risk of death related to cardiovascular disease."
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Let us ponder on some important points taught to us by the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, for our salvation. No foot of a person will move on Judgment Day before being asked about four things: his years and how he spent them, his body and how he used it, his wealth and how he earned and spent it, and about his love towards us, the Ahlul Bayt.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, patience with our children. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, dear friends, it is such an honor to be here at your service. In today's episode, we are going to talk about having patience with our children. So, dear friends, of course, once we get married and we establish this very important pillar of an Islamic lifestyle, which is marriage, well, eventually, if God wills and with the grace and the blessings of the Almighty Allah, one has children. Now, this is another one of the things that, is kind of unsaid, but it is known that the purpose of marriage is to have children, is to bring a new generation into the world, a Muslim generation, a generation which lives an Islamic lifestyle. Now, children, of course, are a gift from the Almighty Allah, and they are a blessing from the Almighty Allah. And one thing that we don't consider, and sometimes we don't really think about, is how children are a trust from the Almighty Allah. Meaning, the Almighty Allah has handed over to us these precious, things in our life which are known as children. And so it is our responsibility, it is our duty to raise our children and raise these children in the best possible manner so that they become good, strong, powerful, intelligent, confident Muslims, and that they are proud to live an Islamic lifestyle. Now, in the process of raising such kids and in the process of bringing up the next generation of Muslims, one of the main things that we are going to have to do, and that is to be patient with them. Welcome back, dear friends. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about how we must be patient with our children. Now, we had said earlier on that the purpose of getting married is to have children and to bring into the world this new generation of Muslims who are proud to live an Islamic lifestyle. Now, marriage in and of itself is nice for a certain period of time, but that's not the end goal. Sure, in some of the traditions it is related that a majority of your religion and your faith is protected by a marriage, but the ultimate purpose of marriage is children. Now, children, at their different various ages, they can be a lot to handle, and they are sometimes difficult to handle. And so because of that, one has to be patient and kind of, live through the separate phases of your children. Now, in a general discussion, because we'll leave the specific details for another day, but overall, we have to be patient and we have to realize that this is no easy task. Raising children, of course, is something which involves a lot of energy, a lot of effort, at times a lot of stress, and at times difficulties and trials. And through all of these, we must turn to the Almighty Allah and make sure that we are patient, because if we are harsh or we become rash or we become angry for no reason, then this will just cause damage to the psychological and spiritual development of our children, and so we must be patient with our children.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Industry.
too.
The problem is that humans often support animals that are attractive. In the meantime, other animals that have not been able to attract people's attention with their appearance do not have a nice future. Today, only about 20 species of animals are classified among the cutest animals in the world, while hundreds of thousands of species of animals live on planet Earth. Of course, during the recent decades, humans have changed the way of choosing animals based on their appearance. Selective and controlled breeding of some animals, such as dogs, which is accompanied by eugenics favored by humans, has caused dangerous and chronic diseases in some of these deformed species. The list of diseases that transgenic dogs and cats suffer from shows that humans have caused increasing problems for animals rather than protecting them. For example, the breeding of these animals in some cases has caused narrow respiratory tracts, weak lungs, skin problems, and corneal ulcers. Creating short arms and legs and long waists in some breeds has led to bone diseases and arthritis. The research shows that in addition to neurological, digestive, and blood diseases, there are also common spinal diseases such as syringomyelia in breeds of dogs. Many cats are prone to digestive problems. Scottish Fold cats to cartilage problems, and Burmese cats to diabetes and asthma. In the meantime, lop rabbits have a short lifespan and hamsters are also facing the risk of brain tumor development. In addition to various diseases, different changes in the body of these animals have caused some of them to face difficulties at birth. Like cats and dogs that have narrowed their waists through eugenics to make them look more beautiful, the only way to remove the fetus from their body is a cesarean section because of the change in their pelvic bone. Now, a significant number of animals that have been modified to be more pleasing to humans are facing a host of health problems, and special clothing, toys, and jeweled food dishes do not seem to be able to cure them. But animal breeding is not the only issue that threatens the lives of pets. Another thing that has caused problems to their health and biological balance in the world is their sterilization by their owners. Surveys show that a large number of pets are sterilized at birth. These animals are sterilized so that their owners can spend time with them safely. Although doing this brings satisfaction to owners, it can have irreparable consequences to animals' health. Sterilization can often lead to abnormal weight gain, cancer, depression, or joint problems. In general, it leads to a reduction in the lifespan of animals. It's a problem that the owners of these animals quickly compensate for by buying another pet. Some animal rights advocates sarcastically remind owners who believe in sterilizing their pets that if pet owners have decided not to have children for any reason, they shouldn't impose it on their animals. This is a clear denial of the natural right to continue the generation of another being who does not have the ability to express his opinion on this matter. Of course, the unrestrained and extensive keeping of pets has not brought disastrous and dangerous results for them alone. During the previous decades, humans have not been spared from the invisible problems caused by this industry. For example, a study conducted in 2017 talks about the environmental effects of pets in America. This research emphasizes that more than 30% of the harmful environmental effect of meat consumption belongs to domestic cats and dogs, a number that will lead to the production of 5 million tons of animal feces and the release of 64 million tons of carbon dioxide and methane in the world. The result of this research shows that the repeated advice of the owners of this profitable industry to the people to keep as many species of animals as possible has ultimately led to a significant contribution to the ecological crisis of the world. This research further emphasizes that, contrary to the general belief that pets consume human food waste, a significant number of them are given high-quality meat that is basically suitable for human nutrition. Compare this issue with the annual death statistics of children who get sick due to malnutrition in different parts of the world is a fundamental challenge for nutrition, health, and human rights experts. Statistics show that in America, 71% of dog owners, 64% of cat owners, 8% of bird owners, and 17% of reptile owners consider these animals not only pets, but members of families. A member that is separated from its original family and joined them not by will, but decision of humans. But the forced separation from the family is only one side of the coin. And the other side of this incident is raising these animals against their usual conditions. Some animals that are instinctively interested in being alone are kept by humans in groups, and others that have to live in groups become lonely creatures in cages that have a short life. In other cases, animals whose lives are more dependent on the night are kept awake by humans during long hours of the day, and animals that need to rest are constantly taken for a walk. Suppressing the basic instincts, sending them to boarding houses while their owners are traveling, training them to observe more hygiene, pure obedience, not harm others, and observing all the rules of human life have caused pets to be reduced to commodity over time. Products that are already found everywhere and in most cases have a low price. Maybe it was for this reason that Elias Canetti, the Bulgarian writer who won the Nobel Prize in 1943, pointed out the same attitude of humans towards animals and criticized animals' low price. This author mentioned the process of commodification of animals and their capture by humans, a process that critics consider to be unethical because animals are not just objects but living creatures with the right to live freely and cannot be captured by anyone. When the price of a hamster, a bird, or a cat is the same as the price of a cup of coffee, it is not surprising that a long list of abused animals that are often bred to become pets comes up. Although the owners of the pet industry do not want to remind and publish these statistics, for example, it should be said that 74,000 animals are abandoned in Britain every year, and about 3,500 street dogs are killed. This figure in America for animals in shelter is a strange and questionable number. 1.5 million animals per year. 1.5 million animals are killed in front of human eyes, but few people can find the related news in the media. Buying, raising, and keeping animals, which was limited in the past centuries, has now become one of the characteristics of the modern lifestyle. A lifestyle that, above all, with the profit-oriented and self-interested attitude owners of the pet industry, seems to be more of a tool for ostentation. Of course, this kind of ostentation is not limited to keeping birds, dogs, cats, and aquatic animals, which are known as popular species. In recent years, the buying and keeping of exotic animals, or in other words, strange animals, has become more and more popular. Species such as snakes, salamanders, eagles, monkeys, and even lions, tigers, and leopards, which are often wild animals that are used as pets at the insistence of buyers. This process, which has taken on uncontrollable dimensions, includes the theft of wild animals from their natural habitat by dealers, their transfer to cities, and their sale at high prices to buyers. It is an incident that not only violated animal rights and harmed the species in the environment, but also caused irreparable harm to humans. The unsuitability of these animals for the urban living environment can increase the risks of living with them and cause the spread of various diseases. Transferring these animals to veterinary centers is considered a difficult and almost impossible task, and in some cases, it can be a threat to the continuation of their generation. If we consider all the things that happen to exotic animals and common animals, we can reach the point that they have been used by humans for centuries. Contrary to what is mentioned in various exhibitions, competitions, and events, the expansion of the pet industry in recent years has led to more human exploitation of them. An industry that violates life and the right to life has inflicted more suffering on animals than benefiting them.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Marshall Islands has demanded extra compensation from U.S. over nuclear tests. The National Cancer Institute says around 55% of all cancers in parts of the Marshall Islands are linked to U.S. nuclear testing. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, the foreign minister of the Marshall Islands has called on Washington to boost compensation payments to the Pacific Island nation as it grapples with health and environmental impacts from the United States' extensive nuclear testing program. Speaking at a U.S. congressional hearing in Washington recently, Jack Adding said, a continuance of his country's Compact of Free Association, COFA, with the United States was rushed through in January without adequate domestic authorization in order to meet a Biden administration budget deadline. Adding told the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, there are other issues that needed to be included, and especially funding for the nuclear-affected populations. The Marshall Islands is one of the three Pacific Island countries which has a COFA arrangement with the United States. Per the agreement, Washington provides assets for the island's defense needs and supplies economic assistance in return for a strategic access to the Pacific. The U.S. is expected to contribute around $7.1 billion in financial assistance to the three nations over the next 20 years, the others being Micronesia and Palau. U.S. military forces conducted 67 nuclear bomb tests on the islands between 1946 and 1958. This included the Castle Bravo thermal nuclear detonation at Atoll in 1954, which remains the largest bomb ever detonated by the United States, forming a 4.5-mile diameter fireball that was visible for more than 250 miles. The U.S. National Cancer Institute has suggested that up to 55% of all cancers in the northern atolls are a result of nuclear fallout and can be directly traced to the Castle Bravo detonation. Last year, more than 100 activist groups, including environmental and arms control campaigners, urged the Biden administration to formally apologize to the Marshall Islands for its nuclear testing program. Joe Yoon, the chief U.S. negotiator with the three Pacific nations, told the hearing recently that he was puzzled by the Marshall Islands' request. He added that the nuclear liability issue had been settled by both parties in the 1980s. And that their existing arrangements contained provisions for a $700 million trust fund, which could be used to deal with issues related to the decades-old nuclear test. Yoon added, I have told my Marshallese colleagues, listen, there is no more money. He also said he believed the November election and rumors of an impending no-confidence vote against its president, David Kabwa, may have influenced the request. Adding denied the claim, saying he was saddened and disappointed by Yoon's comments. According to Los Angeles Times, 5,000 miles west of Los Angeles and 500 miles north of the equator, on a far-flung spit of white coral sand in the Central Pacific, a massive aging and weathered concrete dome bobs up and down with the tide. Here in the Marshall Islands, Ronit Dome holds more than 3.1 million cubic feet, or 35 Olympic-sized swimming pools of U.S.-produced radioactive soil and debris, including lethal amounts of plutonium. Nowhere else has the U.S. saddled another country with so much of its nuclear waste, a product of its Cold War atomic testing program. Between 1946 and 1958, the United States detonated 67 nuclear bombs on, in and above the Marshall Islands, vaporizing whole islands, carving craters into its shallow lagoons, and exiling hundreds of people from their homes. Now the concrete coffin, which locals call the tomb, is at risk of collapsing from rising seas and other effects of climate change. Tides are creeping up its sides, advancing higher every year as distant glaciers melt and ocean waters rise. To many in the Republic of the Marshall Islands, Ronit Dome is the most visible manifestation of the United States nuclear legacy, a symbol of the sacrifices the Marshallese made for the U.S. security and the broken promises they received in return. They blame the United States and other industrialized countries for global climate change and sea level rise, which threatens to submerge vast swathes of these island nations' 29 low-lying atolls. Marshallese leaders acknowledge that America bears full responsibility for their nation's distress, but they say the United States has failed to take ownership of the environmental catastrophe it left behind, and they claim U.S. authorities have repeatedly deceived them about the magnitude and extent of that devastation. A Times review of thousands of documents and interviews with U.S. and Marshallese officials found that American government withheld key pieces of information about the dome's contents and its weapons testing program before the two countries signed a compact in 1986, releasing the U.S. government from federal liability. One example, the United States did not tell the Marshallese that in 1958, it shipped 130 tons of soil from its atomic testing grounds in Nevada to the Marshall Islands. U.S. authorities also didn't inform people in Eniwet, where the waste site is located, that they'd conducted a dozen biological weapons tests in the atoll, including experiments with an aerosolized bacteria designed to kill enemy troops.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's program, we'll be discussing the recent IMF bailout package secured by Pakistan and Iran-Saudi relations, which can positively impact Pakistan. So stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Pakistan's vicious IMF cycle, and we shall also take a look at Pakistan's growth in the backdrop of Iran-Saudi relations.